Welcome to the Visual Storytelling Podcast. My name is Fred Ranger, and I'm so happy that you're joining us today for another exciting conversation. Today I have a very, very special guest, somebody I've been trying to get on the podcast for a long time, but he's finally here, and his name is Ulysses Aoki, and he's from Japan. First off, Ulysses, thank you so much for being here on the podcast.
No, thank you. I love your voice, and I love this mic and everything that's happening here. Thanks.
Well, we were discussing pre-show about, getting a good sound and a good setup, but I think what I'm most excited about today, Ulysses, is about the stories that you've been telling, both online and offline. But before we get into like the nitty-gritty of the actual visual storytelling of your work, can you walk us through a little bit more on how you became a photographer, visual storyteller, always driven by art in its purest form? So can you walk us through kind of the path that led you to becoming that great artist that you are today?
Thank you. Yeah, it can be quite a long story, but I'll try to make it as concise as possible. This phrase is thrown around a lot, but I was actually on the receiving end of a camera for my longer part of my life. So since I was a little kid in Japan, I was actually into fashion modeling. Haha, it's funny. I know. But I've done that for like 15 years or so. And then in university, when I was getting really serious about it, I found it really funny that I didn't know anything about the camera, even though I've been around it for like 15 years. So I decided to, I did like this really weird teaching gig for like a summer, and then I bought my first camera so I can study what the camera does. And from there on, I got interested into, I started with portrait photography to study about the camera and how it interacts with people. And then I realized that I just want to take more photos. So even after the portrait sessions, I started roaming around the streets with it because I just couldn't get enough of photography. And then that's where I started to learn that photography can be an art form. And I started studying the greats, Joel Meyerowitz and Elliot Erwitz and the Magnum guys and Matt Stewart and all the hot guys at that time. That was about close to 10 years or so. And that's how I really started to get into the art of photography and candid photography for me.
And would you say that basically the camera brought you to being more curious about the world itself, or how did the actual camera itself unlocked a whole array of things that you weren't exposed to before photography?
Oh yeah, 100%. To be brutally honest, I wasn't even remotely interested in going anywhere, going outside of Japan, going to different parts of Japan, even roaming around the streets of Tokyo itself. It was just something that never crossed my mind, because I felt very numb, I guess, to whatever was happening around me. I was a terrible kid. Like I would, my parents would take me to great places and then teach me about history there, and I would just not be interested. I know I'm a brat, but through photography, I started to really get interested in my surroundings and hopefully, make a great photograph out of wherever I was. So that's kind of, my story. Yeah.
That's a great story. And I think there's one common thread for all photographers, or I would say visual storytellers, is that the minute you discover that art form, it opens so many doors. It actually makes you more aware of your surrounding. And to your point, maybe it brings you from being a terrible kid to a good kid who appreciates the surrounding and the history and all this great stuff. But if we go back to the actual art form, storytelling, right? So is that something you discovered through photography and maybe filmmaking? We're going to talk about that later. Or was that something that was always on top of your mind, but you didn't really know how to express it or how to do it? Were you somebody who was drawing before? Sometimes people tell stories in various ways. So were you always attracted to visual storytelling? Or is that something you discovered with photography?
Yeah, it's a great question. I ask myself that question that a lot, even today. I do think I'm not a naturally artistic person, but I had a lot of art around me, and it's really funny actually. My parents were both in the art publishing industry, so they worked at Feiden and Taschen, and so my house, and they were actually the heads in Japan. So it's funny. I had like a million art books in my house, and I had gigantic Joel Meyerowitz books and more traditional art forms too, and all these great photo books that we all lust over right now because they're a bit expensive, right? But I just never read them. They were just around me, and I just was never interested. And then now, that I'm into it, I gotta rebuy these books that were just laying around the house, right? So yeah, I guess the answer is I was always exposed to wonderful art, and I just never found out my interest in it, I guess, because I was always into sports as a kid, and I was actually traveling around Japan and the world playing soccer in my youth, which is very football, sorry. Well,
Well,
yeah, so I
Canada, we
never
say
had the
soccer too, by the
opportunity, I
way.
guess.
Canada, we say soccer too, so
Yeah.
you're good.
Oh, okay, great. The correct way. No, sorry. But yeah, so I guess I never had the time and opportunity to be exposed to art too much. I had a few attempts where I would try to draw a bit, try to paint a bit. They were always terrible, but I always had the desire to do that somewhere, I think. But yeah, that's how it happened, I guess. Yeah.
So did you start it off taking, photos and just editing them or processing them, should I say, and keeping them for yourself? Were you already versed into the social media side also of sharing your work? Was it more the printing side because of your parents and the publishing? So what was your, because it's fun to take photos, but how did you started to communicate those stories through various touch points?
That's a good question too. So I did buy my first camera, and that was a digital Canon. I don't know, those
Rebel
really nice.
something, Rebel, whatever.
Yes, the Rebels. Yeah, they're actually a different name in Japan, but yeah, the Rebel something. But what actually really sparked, I guess, my interest in what really started to get me going was I bought my first film camera when I was like 23 or so, and that was I got like the Contax T2. That was
Wow.
a little bit before it was
Before
popularized
the
by celebrities, I guess, if you can call them. And yeah, once I got that, I really kind of went crazy over everything, and then I started to just take photos every day during my lunch breaks at work, and then wake up early before and do, before my commute and all that. So to answer your question, actually, I really started to take photos during kind of my film era, if you can call it that. And so not much processing because it was film. So it was very purist in a way where I would get scans or I would scan them myself. And then from then on, I started a small, well, as no one knew about it, I started an Instagram page to post my photos. I actually had a personal Instagram profile with like 20 followers, maybe. We're just friends. And then I started to, after a certain point, I started to post every day after that. And but posting a photo that you believe in for film every day is was quite a challenge. So yeah, I had to keep up with my photos, and that I pushed myself to post a photo that I would be content for. Yeah. And I did that for like a year or two, if I remember.
And were you happily surprised with the results? Like, what was the response on it? And also, you were shooting film when it wasn't that cool to shoot film, I guess, with the time frame you're referring to, and having a Contax T2 or G2, whatever the Contax you had today, you would have to empty your bank account and start with that hashtag film is not dead, and have 33 people following you and trying to build around it. So were you there at the right time, Ulysses, with your film sharing?
So not many people were looking at my account in the first place. So that side of the story is accurate, but it was true. Film was very cheap, actually. I always bought those like 3-pack Fuji Superior 400s because that was what Matt Stewart was using.
Yeah.
So I got that. Those sold for like $10. So that's like, I'm trying to do my math. I'm trying to get my Asian brain going, but 108 frames, right? So 36 times 3.
Yeah.
For $10. So that's pretty cheap, you know.
Not anymore.
I just went through rolls like crazy. I think, I might have said this somewhere in my YouTube channel when I started it, but I think I shot like 1,000 rolls in like 2 or 3 years.
Wow. Yeah. And always with the context, or you did upgrade or change that setup down the road? I saw you with an M6 at some point. Is that still in the mix? Mm-hmm. Or
So after the T2, I did try a few other cameras, but what really started to click with me, no pun intended, was the M6. Yeah, and then that's where I really started to waste some film.
Yeah, I can relate. M6 is right there, and there's just something about it that makes it so enjoyable to shoot. And also, you know, there might be a bit of the placebo effect where, to your point, you're like, well, this is what Joel shot with, this is what Henri Cartier-Bresson, well, not the M6, but Leica, and Matt and all these guys, and you're like, okay, I have a bit of a history in my hand, and I'm not saying that I'm making history, but I'm participating in that movement where you have something so mechanical, so organic, that it removes any of the, you know, unknown in the equation. You're controlling every single thing on this camera, and it, for me at least, I don't know if you're the same, but if it's a bad photo, it's 100% your fault, and if it's a good photo, it's 100%, you know, your fault too. So that's a great way of seeing commitment towards the art form.
No, yeah, I agree, because especially with digital, you know, the editing is such an important part of the digital process, that having the confidence that, oh, this is the setup that Matt's using, you know, or this is the setup that Joel was using. You stick a 35 mil lens on an M6 or something, and you shoot film, and then it's basically the same thing. And so, as you said, like, no excuses, right? So exactly. I love that. Yeah,
exactly. And how is it in Japan right now? Is it as crazy as in the US, Canada, with, like, you know, Portra, $25 a roll of Portra 400? Is it the same situation? If you can get some?
Yes. Okay. It's crazy. So I recently just have been dabbling with film again, just for fun. But yeah, so I went to the scanning lab just recently. The rolls are crazy, but also the scanning and the processing is crazy too. So I'm just like, nah, not I don't feel like doing this again. It's crazy. Yeah.
So and this will be maybe the last portion about gear. But so what are you shooting with? And maybe we can talk about your YouTube channel, because you do share your experience with various cameras. But like, what's in your kit today? What do you go out? I'm sure some of the listeners are curious to know what Ulysses Aoki shoots with at this very moment.
Are they? Wow. Okay. I have to say, I feel like I am going through a bit of a crisis recently. I wouldn't say like it's a negative crisis. It's more of like a questioning of recent gear, because they're all kind of the same thing now.
Yeah.
They're all really good, but sometimes the cameras are too good these days, right? They don't have the mojo. Like they all kind of look the same. They have kind of the same sensors. The thing is I shoot, and I have like a camera that I shoot with often. I use mainly the Leica SL2S. I have the reporter edition.
It's a beautiful one. I saw it on your Instagram or your YouTube, I forgot, but man, that color, it's just bang on, man.
Yeah, it's a beautiful camera, and that's kind of one of the only reasons why I got it, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, because the AF sucks, and the there's no value in that, you know, versus a Sony or a Fuji or whatever, but it's a good-looking camera.
Yeah,
but I understand also it's aligned with the rest of, you know, the Leica shooting experience, I would say.
Yeah, no, I agree. So that was the kind of reasoning I got it. So I usually have like a few pocket cameras laying around. I shoot with a really, really beaten up like point and shoot zoom. I shoot a lot with the Canon G7X Mark II. Don't ask me why. I just have it and I've been shooting with it. Also shoot with the Ricoh GR3X. The guys at Ricoh in Japan have lent it to me for like 2 years, so I think it's just mine. I'm sorry at this point. So yeah, I have like a few pocketable digital cameras so I can shoot anytime really nimbly. And I, when I'm really just in the mode for just shooting, then I bring my SL2S. Usually these days with a zoom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the Leica zoom or the Sigma ones?
Yeah. So right now I'm shooting with the 24-105. Okay. It's a Panasonic.
Panasonic. Yeah.
I use that or I adapt M lenses to it. But yeah, for the zoom lens, yeah, I use it. I think they're all kind of the same.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the M lenses, I guess it's interesting because you can have that bit more character. You know, I don't know what M lenses you shoot with, but I find on my M10R that, you know, I get different results. And to your point, any recent modern mirrorless camera, there's no differences anymore. I completely agree. And you have to kind of go back to older sensors to get that different vibe or that different look. I'm thinking X Pro 2. I think you were a user too back then. That was a bit different than the rest of the competition. But these days, everything is clinically perfect. And there is a world for that if you're a product photographer, real estate, and so on. You know, go get your Sonys and so on. But anyways, I don't want this to turn into a gear show. Let's go back to the art form. And also, I want to hear about your thought process around YouTube, because you've been a very highly participant in the YouTube space, both from your own channel, but also collaborating with people like Samuel Streetlife, your friends, I guess, down in Japan. I don't know where he is in the world right now, but I guess you guys collaborated there. Also, Alex, that I know very well. I actually shot with him in New York. Good guy also. But I know you've had conflicting emotions towards the medium itself. So I'm more interested in learning more about your thought process there, because I think you're back recently on the platform. You've been on and off. So what's your thought process there, and what do you get from having a YouTube channel in 2023?
Wow. Yeah, it's a loaded question. So I have to say that I started my YouTube channel after I got into the rhythm of shooting a lot, after a few years. And then I had an interview with Samuel Streetlife. He's a great YouTuber. He's been doing the YouTube photography stuff for years. And he told me that I should be on YouTube. And so I always had the idea on the back of my mind, but I wasn't necessarily skilled or knowledgeable about anything in life. So when I had enough knowledge, I think, and enough experience to talk about something about, which was photography, that's when I started my channel. So that was the background. But one of the reasons I started was also to share my journey in this art form too. And because I felt like not many photographers on YouTube were doing that, where let's say like more from like an artistic experience. I've seen more like traditional artists like painters, for example, on YouTube doing that, where they're exposing their audience to their journey of trying to become a great artist. And I wanted to try to do that with my channel, while, you know, sharing whatever I learned on the way. So my approach to YouTube has, in that sense, like never been like heavily YouTube-y, I guess, and that's, if you can call it that. So I try not to do the YouTube photographer stuff as much as possible, but at the same time, it's also hard because it's hard to, resist that, because when you're spending, as you may know, When you're spending hours and hours and hours making a video and editing it and thinking about the next video and ideas you just put into video, and then, oh, now you need a video camera, now you need a great mic, and now you need this and that, right? It's really hard to not put an effort to make something work out on the platform. So it has been like a battle in that sense, where it's like, how much artistic integrity do I keep on my channel, and how much do I cater towards an audience or a new audience on the platform? That's kind of been the bane of my existence for a few years, I think. But at the same time, yeah, I think the social media platforms that are popular and bustling these days are pretty much set. You know, Instagram's there. It's been kind of weird, but you know, it's there, still there. Twitter is kind of on the rise, but it's
been weird
this past year.
Yes.
Yep. But YouTube isn't going away, you know? Yeah. And so it's a great place to market yourself. It's a great way to expose yourself to people that are interested in your work. And it's a great way to connect like this, you know, like I get to talk to people that I have never imagined I can. And you know, Japan is still a small island. And there's actually not many candid photographers in this island, which is contrary to popular belief, I think. So it's been great connecting with people in Europe and North America and everywhere, actually. Yeah.
I completely agree with you. And I like what you're saying about using those platforms to connect, because like you, I started my channel because I wanted to share my process. And along the way, I think I've learned more through interactions with viewers and subscribers than they learned from me. And I'm not saying that lightly. And it's not just about photography or about cameras. I actually learned about, you know, art in general, and discovering inspiration through conversation that I had with these people. And we were talking pre-show about the fact that I now have connections with Phil Penman and Matt Stewart and all these guys, because they said yes, because you have to be careful with comments and so on and so forth. Because if you only look at Instagram and you think that this is the photography community, that's not it, man. That's definitely not how photographers interact. We're pretty much way more approachable and open-minded than you can see on Instagram and even YouTube. I see some of the comments out there about, and it's usually the about the brands that you shoot and who freaking cares what brand do you shoot and stuff. But it's in some weird ways it became kind of a brand platform. But if you use it the right way, to your point, to connect, to open your mind, to talk about stuff that are inspiring, I think it can be very powerful. And thank you for being on the platform and not just playing the algorithm and not just playing the YouTube game. And there's a place for that. And there's people who do it tremendously well. But just like Alex and yourself and Samuel, I think that you guys have you're bringing value to the platform. Again, you're not just trying to be a copycat of other, you know, YouTubers that are talking about photography. So kudos on that. And even I see that you have a video about making YouTube videos, so I entice people to go see it. It's called Making YouTube Videos Is Hard, and here's how. So you're a bit of a you know, dichotomy here, but that's great. That's what we need, because there's more people that could benefit even from a mental health. If you block some of the negativity on the platform and the negative comments, there's a lot of positive, you know, interacting with people from around the globe in real time. That's very powerful. But I want to go back to the actual art form itself. So we did mention that you are a visual storyteller. But for you, when you look at either your own work or other people's work, what makes you tick? What makes you have goosebumps when you see an image or a story that, you know, you're being absorbed by? What makes a good image in the end? I know it's a open-ended question, but...
Yeah, wow. That's a hard question. I do have to say that has been changing, you know, over time, because I wouldn't say you get numb or anything, but, you know, there are, what would you say, the more you learn about photography and the more you are exposed to great photography, the more you start to understand the possibilities of what it is to take a photograph, or what it is the camera's doing, or what it is the human eye is capable of doing when it's, you know, when its abilities are maxed out, I guess you can call it that, gaming. But yeah, so in a way, like, I've, over the past years of shooting and learning about many photographers, I have learned about a lot of genres and a lot of ways of shooting. You know, a good example being, and I think this is I'm speaking for a lot of people here when I say this, but you know, when you start off taking photos and you learn about Joel Meyerowitz, it's like, wow, like, how in the world do you take these photos? And then you look at Alex Webb's work and it's just like, what in the name of God is happening here? And then you look at, you know, someone on an opposing, not opposing, but like a different spectrum. You look at Sol Leiter's work and then Ernst Haas, and then you go, wow, those are beautiful images. And how in the world did they take those photos in 1950, right? And then you go to someone like Pinkasov, and then it's, now you have a graphic element and a beautiful color element in this, and moments. And so it really depends on, I think, the phase of life you're in, the, where you're at with your photography, what your common interests are at too. In terms of me though, yeah, at this point, I'm always looking for new stuff, like types of photographs that I have never seen before, or methods of shooting that wow me. So in that sense, yeah, I am pretty drawn to photographers like Ernst Haas and Pinkasov, because they have always like provided very new ways of seeing the world through a camera. Although, you know, Ernst Haas has been gone for years and decades. Still, you look at his photos and see how much of an innovator he was. He also shot images of nature and landscapes, not only humans, not only the cities, and anything from like abstract stuff too. So yeah, to me, it's always, I love looking at photographs that make me question, how did this person see this? Because this person saw this happening and then knew that they should take a photo of this. So yeah, I guess that's what I'm drawn to. And it's usually a combination of things like color or contrast and graphical elements, and maybe a moment here or there. That's everything. Sorry.
It's so true what you say, and it removes any, you know, any of the technical aspect of it. I mean, I was discussing with, I think it was Dotan Sagi, who I actually also work, I also love the work a lot, but he said that some of the best photos, and I agree, in the history of photography are pretty much soft and out of focus. But it's about, to your point, other things, the contrast, the movement, the emotion that it conveys. And I think I would sum up what you're saying by, it makes you feel something at the end of the day, right? So it's not necessarily about to what we're saying, the technical aspect of it. And also, I love the fact that you're talking about all of these different genres, because it's not something that's set in stone. It's not something that, oh, I like this and I will like this for the rest of my life. It's like music, it's like wine, it's like anything that can evolve over time. And it's the beauty of it. But I need to bring you, and I think you have a video about that too, but I need to bring you on a slippery slope. Here's the question. All that we just said is great. What about AI? And I don't know if you know I was going there, but AI can do all of that and more, and maybe a new art form, to your point. So are you afraid that at one point you might be seduced or interested in AI photography, or is that something that you're still debating or trying to evolve with?
No, I'm not interested at all, actually. I think, and this is where I do believe that there is reasoning to developing technical ability as a photographer too. And the reasoning is this: AI is an amalgamation of data. You know, they're basing their result or resulting image based off of existing images. All of this pool of images, right? So in a way, you still need people that can innovate the whatever it is, the method to photography, or a new approach to photography, or a new kind of way of expressing the image or the reality before their eyes. So, you know, without the Ernst Haas's of his time, or without the Pinkasoffs, or without the, and you know, whoever it is that is a very great innovator at that time, you won't get those beautiful images that AI creates. And in a way, I do think that that is the responsibility of a great photographer, of expressing their vision in a new way through a camera. And that's also why I do believe that AI has its own place, where I think it's very similar to like stock imagery, where, for example, like a good example would be in Japan, the most probably photographed thing is Mount Fuji or something. It's, you know, the trademark mountain. So in that sense, you can take a very bland image of Mount Fuji. And sadly, I think AI can replicate that. But what AI can't do is, I don't know, express Mount Fuji in a very new light, in a way that, don't ask me how, but, you know, in a different setting or a different scene, or a different light, or maybe you're using Mount Fuji as one part of an image. I know one image that Jesse Marlowe, a photographer that I highly respect, he took a photo of Mount Fuji while he's on the bullet train there. And yeah, that really, I starkly remember that image just because it's so unlike any other Mount Fuji photo that it's like, yeah, this is what pushes the boundaries, and this is what AI can't do.
I like that because it's the human aspect of it. I'm definitely not against AI. I will, you know, learn it. I will grow with it. I will see what it can do. I think there is a place for, you know, image restoration and creating new art form. Again, yeah. I'm not close to it, but there will always be a place for photography. But I think it will make photography a bit more interesting, to be honest, and to go back to old mediums like film or like older sensors and so on, to differentiate from a newly published, you know, from the past 5 years or the next 5 years AI-driven image. So I think it'll create... I think if you're a product photographer, I wish you good luck, though, because you can replicate any freaking product very precisely. I would look for another job, and again, and no offense to any product photographers, probably... some great product photographers out there, but in the next 2 to 5 years, you need to be more versatile, do video or do something else, because that job of product photography is, I think, challenged by AI a lot. But to your point, something that's more towards the storytelling, the uniqueness of a moment that happened on planet Earth, that's not necessarily, you know, a robot creation, that will stay. Yeah. And just like, you know, you've got vinyls to listen to music, you've got cassettes, you've got CDs, you've got streaming, you've got FLAC, and so on and so forth. So it depends on what you are feeling for, and it'll be a market for all of them. I'm sure there's companies out there who are thinking about how we're going to monetize the SHIT out of it. I'm trying to keep my clean rating on the on the podcast. And again, it's just evolution. It's not something photographers, and I know it's a big debate right now, but I don't think photographers should fight it. I think just like you, they should reflect on it and see how, you know, it will evolve, and where do you want to stand in that realm and that new world that's about to open up. Where I do think it's going to be hard, it's when robots starts to feed other robots, like we see in Auto, GPT, and all these great stuff, where the human element is actually abstract, like it's actually removed from the equation, and then it builds something on its own. Very interesting from a technology standpoint, evolution standpoint, but from a photography standpoint, I'm not very interested to see that happening. robots feeding other robots to create new images.
Yeah, you're scaring me now.
Well, deep stuff, but, deep stuff.
Yeah, if I may add two more little
yes.
points. One thing is, I think with AI, it has really led me to start questioning, like, just purely like beautiful images that I see.
Yeah,
it's because when you see something too pretty now, it's like, well, is that really, you know, it might be AI, because AI is really good. I said they. Wow, I feel like they're
there. You go, the robots, the robots.
yeah, they're very good at, you know, creating something beautiful or creating something that they believe humans like. So in that sense, yeah, I do question just pretty images that I see online. Another one is, I think the value of the reputation of a photographer will go up.
I like that.
What I'm saying is, you need the viewers, sadly, will start to need to look into who that photographer is or who's the one that's creating that image. And so there's going to be even more value on your reputation. Like, what I'm saying is, if they see an image that is said to be taken by me or has some kind of affiliation with my name, then what needs to be happening is the viewer needs to be, oh, this is an image that Ulysses actually took. It's not AI generated, and I can trust him. So that connection and reputation really starts becoming really important going forward, I think.
I love that point. I think it's probably the most important thing in terms of differentiating AI from human-driven or human-created images. Having that style, that signature, will become very, very important. If you are a professional, and again, that's another topic we can debate, what's a professional photographer versus not professional, but if you earn a living from making photographs, you'll have to have that style. People will hire you and not your camera or not your AI skills like we just discussed. So I think this is a great point, Ulysses. How is it in Japan, though? So, I mean, you live in the Mecca for a lot of people from like me externally. We're like, wow, this guy and these guys live in the Mecca of street photography and visual storytelling. But for you, it's your reality. It's day in, day out. You see those neons. You see those little bars, you know, sake places and stuff. How is it to live there and to be a photographer? And you've traveled around the world. How do you compare it to other vibes for being a photographer in that city, in that country?
Oh, yeah. I would say, you know, it all ends up being, it's dependent on what you want as a photographer, right? If you are into nightlife and people going crazy at night, you know, and bars and clubs and then people getting pissed drunk at, you know, in on the streets, then Tokyo's great, you know. But I don't know. I enjoy shooting in Tokyo because it does provide a lot of different kinds of opportunities. You can go to one station on this major line, train line, and that's Shibuya, for example, where, you know, there's a lot of people and then it's a lot of neon signs and a lot of nightlife. And then you might, you know, take three stops to a different way, and then it's a whole different story. It's a business district, and it's more like high rises and lots of glass. So yeah, the great part about Tokyo is definitely its diversity in just how it's constructed, in depending on each location. So they, and all of these locations provide very different aesthetics, which is interesting and very, it's very exciting in that sense. But again, yeah, it really depends on what you want, because, you know, I'm heavily into like dense colors in general. So it is hard to see those. It's hard to, I don't know, come by those situations when you have such a dense city built on concrete and glass and neon signs, because there's really just colors everywhere. And it's really hard to focus and create a tight composition. So yeah, it just, again, depends on what you want. It's not, I would say it's not for everyone, but it's great in the different kinds of opportunities that it provides.
And in a city of 13 million people, is it is it hard to create those stories? That I'm, and I've seen a lot of, you know, videos, that some from you and Alex and Samuel, but it seems that you kind of need a 28 millimeter because it's so dense, to your point, so much, so many people in some areas. So how do you make sense of that, and how do you compose in a city where there's so many people, so many things happening? How do you make abstraction of the bustling stories that are happening in front of you?
Yeah. So if you want a lot of people in your frame,
yeah, that's good.
Then it's great. If you don't want a lot of people in your frame, then well, you're in some trouble.
Yeah.
I actually joke about this a lot with a fellow photographer. His name is Lance Stein. I think he's based in Italy, but he comes to Japan a lot. But we say that in Tokyo, especially, well, in Japan in general, actually, but where there's great light, there is absolutely nobody. But where there is terrible light, everyone is there. Just because with the high rises in the city, a lot of it is actually most of the day, it's based on shadow. It's very shadowy.
Yeah.
And when you get the best light in the early morning and in the late afternoons light is low and the sun is low, but the low light doesn't come in because there are buildings that are blocking it. Right. But you go to the countryside and the light is amazing, but there's just nobody there. So yeah, I mean, it does pose its own challenges. And you do have a few like dilemmas that you need to go through when you're photographing here. Those are the majority of my feelings when I shoot here. But if you are the type of person that has a wide angle lens and wants to shoot, you know, people in a dense area, then it is wonderful. But yeah, you really need to like consider how to compose the image, because if you don't, then you just get a million photographs of a million people packed in a space. So
any recommendation for people who want to see another side of Japan that you're not seeing on Instagram with all those street photographers? Any photographer that maybe from a book perspective you would recommend to buy just to get immersed in another side of photography in Japan and Tokyo?
Doesn't have to be a
Japanese photographer, but like just somebody who did some work in your country that's not the usual, to your point, alley with the neon signs, the reflection in the water pond and stuff, like it's, you know, that the stuff we're used to seeing day in and day out on Instagram that makes a banger, if that's still a word in 2023.
Yeah,
like something, another aspect. I haven't used that word in a long time, but I felt it felt right in the moment.
I haven't heard it in a while, so you got caught off guard.
Yeah,
you know what's really funny? I also talk about this a lot with Lance too. But there are actually, you know, there are a lot of people that photograph Japan, but if you look into like the archive of Magnum photographers, for example, there aren't much expansive bodies of work done in Tokyo.
Huh.
I know that Bruce Gilden
has
a lot of work in Tokyo, but so again, those are more like,
but it's the same style. He has that close focusing to the face flash, being like the same he does in New York, right? I guess he did the same in Japan.
Yeah. And so the thing is, especially I'm heavily invested in color photography.
Yeah.
When you look into color photography, there actually isn't much work done here. So one of the only references that I have, in a way, and I'm sorry to bring it up so many times, but there's this book by Georgi Pinkasov. Pinkasov has a book done in Tokyo, and it's one of the only more graphical, I guess, ways of expressing Tokyo through photography that I've seen. And that's kind of one of my Bibles, if you can call it that, just because it's such a rare thing to, again, yeah, see Tokyo in a light that's not gritty black and white, or that isn't about a bunch of neon signs or a bunch of taxi drivers. And it's very rare. So I do drive a lot of, I do get a lot of inspiration from his book.
I'll put it in the show notes. If you can send me the link to the book, I think it's, again, I really want to drive people to different visual stories than the ones we're seeing on the usual platform. So when you have a chance, if you can send me the link, I'll put it in the show notes, and I invite all the listeners to go take a look and actually let us know, you know, to Ulysses and myself, like, what are your inspiration? I'm sure there is someone out there that has a very unique, you know, book about Japan, or even Tokyo precisely. What's your
Yeah, if there are any recommendations, 100%, I really want to know.
And what's your
the
second?
The book I was talking about was...
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry?
No, sorry
I cut you off. The book I was talking about is called, it's called Sidewalk. Just
Sidewalk, but, okay. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I will put it in the show notes. Thank you for sharing it. And what's your second favorite place to shoot in Japan? Like, if somebody wants to, again, go out of the usual suspect like Tokyo and...
Great question. There are, it really depends on what you want. And that's the great part about Japan, definitely, is it's very diverse. So
maybe something less big city bustling like Tokyo, maybe something quite different.
Yeah. So I have two places that I really like. One is, if you want to shoot landscape or if you want to shoot, I don't know, just something very grandiose. Hokkaido is the most northern part of Japan. Very, very close to Russia, actually. And it gets really snowy during the winter. And during the summer, the nature there is just absolutely amazing. So, I mean, less people, but it's just so beautiful. It's a great place to go to. Another recommendation, if you want people, is Kyoto is obviously great. It's I actually enjoy shooting there a little bit more than Tokyo. The buildings are much lower than in Tokyo, so you actually get good light there. And also, they have a lot of regulation on preserving more historic buildings and preserving a certain streamlined aesthetic in their city. So you actually get naturally very beautiful buildings, and then it's very streamlined.
Nice.
So it's a little bit easier to get a composed color photograph there, at least in my opinion.
Then we invite all the listeners to go visit. And now it's the stupid question, but now it's fully open, right? There's no more restriction. I know it's been a year or something that it's back to fully normal. Do you feel any restriction, or is it like completely back to what it was before the pandemic years?
Yeah, I think it's completely back. Okay. I mean, thank God it's taken like 2 to 3 years.
Crazy.
So it's very welcome. But yeah, I think it's fully back. Yeah,
awesome.
Very crowded these days.
Top of my list for sure. And I'll let you know when I'm there, and maybe we can go grab a drink and go out and shoot. And maybe record a sequel to this episode, because I think next time we chat, I want to talk about the projects that you're working on. Maybe you can give us a glimpse of what you're working on right now. Do you have an ongoing project from multiple years that you're continuing, or you're just, you know, going day by day and shooting? So what's up with Ulysses right now?
Thanks. So I have like two projects, I guess if you can call it that. One is, as you said, kind of like an ongoing one that I'm trying to put a end date on it as a mark. And that end date would be like a 10-year anniversary to me roaming the streets. So
nice.
And that's inching closer. So I'm trying to really find, I don't know, an end to this endless roaming. An end to this endless roaming. Yeah, that's cool. Let's just call it that. But yeah, Tokyo has changed a lot in this past 10 years. Obviously, we had the Olympics and we had the pandemic. And there are a lot of structural changes that has happened and a lot of kind of economic ups and downs actually during this 10-year period. So I thought it would be an interesting way to place to kind of end the book. It would be 2025-ish, I think. So I'm aiming for that. And the other one is a more, the other project that I have going on is a more conceptual one. And that one is based off of a poem by Robert Frost called Fire and Ice. And I've been, the poem explores concepts of how the world would end, basically. And it's a very grim poem, I guess, in a way. But it's funny because when you take photographs of fire and ice, it seems more beautiful and glamorous than what the poem might indicate. So it's been a very interesting concept to work around. And yeah, that's something that I don't exactly know when it's going to end, but I've been constantly kind of working around it. Yeah.
Nice. So we'll make sure to follow that. And if you want to send people to kind of see what you're up to, where would you like to send them first? Online, I mean. Maybe not at your house, but online.
Yeah, not my house. Oh, if you can come, yeah, I'll make a coffee or something.
And, oh, that's good. We can we'll take coffee. You up on the offer.
Yeah. I think I do have a website with some of my photographs and my projects, so that would be a great place to see what kind of photos I've been taking. If you want more like daily imagery updates, then Instagram is obviously where all photographers live and thrive. So that's good. If you want to hear me ramble like this, which might be a very small minority of you guys, then you can come pop up to my YouTube channel, which is great because you get to pick my brain as much as you want. So yeah, that's kind of where I live, if you may call it that.
Yes. Nice, nice. So I really want to thank you, Ulysses, for your generosity. You've been such a great guest. We've talked about so many great things. I feel we could, you know, over a glass of sake, we could talk for hours about all the great stuff we talked about: visual storytelling, AI, where the world is going, some of the gear that we use, and why we're even bothering, you know, investing time, effort into the art of photography. So again, thank you so much for being on the show, Ulysses, and I will let you know when I'm in Japan. Please do the same if you're in North America, Canada, the US. We will connect. We did it last time, Alex and I, when we were in New York. So let's reunite all the photographers that we were connected online, offline, so we can actually make great connections. But again, I want to thank you, Ulysses, for your time today. And I wish you a very pleasant rest of your night. It's very, very late right now in Tokyo. And I guess we'll chat soon.
Cool. Thank you, Fred. It was a pleasure. Hope to talk to you soon.
Cheers. Set these rails on fire.